In our series in Luke, which has been something of a disjointed series, as I have been off and on in the pulpit, we come to Luke chapter 12 and verses 35 through 48. And it concerns being ready. And I'm going to read that text now. Now, to put this in context, he has just denounced being covetous when a man asked him to help get the inheritance divided. Then he told his disciples, "Don't be worried, because your Father knows you need these things." And now we go on to be ready. Be dressed in readiness. Keep your lamps lit. Be like men who are waiting for their master when he returns from the wedding feast, so they may immediately open the door to him when he comes and knocks. Blessed are those slaves whom the master will find on the alert when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will gird himself to serve and have them recline at the table and will come up and wait on them. Whether he comes in the second watch or even the third and finds them so, blessed are those slaves. But be sure of this, that if the head of the house had known at what hour the thief was coming, he would have not allowed his house to be broken into. You too be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour that you do not expect. And Peter said, "Lord, are you addressing this parable to us or to everyone else as well?" And the Lord said, "Who then is the faithful and sensible steward whom his master will put in charge of his servants to give them their rations at the proper time? Blessed is that slave whom his master finds so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you, he will put him in charge of all his possessions. But if that slave says in his heart, 'My master will be a long time in coming,' and begins to beat the slaves, both men and women, and to eat and drink and get drunk, the master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect, and an hour he does not know, and will cut him in pieces and assign him a place with the unbelievers. And that slave who knew his master's will and did not get ready or act in accord with his will receive many lashes. But the one who did not know it and committed deeds worthy of a flogging will receive but few. From everyone who has been given much, much will be required. And to whom they have entrusted much, of him they will ask all the more." And so, I have a question for you tonight. For what circumstance are you ready? Ready for what? Now, once in a conversation a long time ago when I was young, an old woman spoke to me about being ready. She told me that any sensible woman was always ready in case a baby might come. Now, she was born in the late 1800s, or the early 1900s maybe. Clothing was generally not bought off the shelf at that time. Well-to-do people went to a tailor or a seamstress, and common people made their own. So aside from the work that always comes with staying up nights and feeding and endless washing, we could ask Katie, she'd tell us. Aside from all this work, in those days, this coming blessed event meant lots of knitting and sewing for the mother and maybe her family and friends, because the clothing for the baby would be handmade. And she said the prudent woman would have a bag or box somewhere stashed away with some soft flannel that could be cut and sewn, and diapers and clothing for the infant to give her a start on the sewing and knitting that she would need for a new baby. Now, my father, when we were on the farm, had things hung up on a nail or a peg different places in the barn, right where he could find them by feel, so he could go down and do chores in case there was an outage and there was no lights. Most of us carry a jack and a spare tire in our automobile in case we should have a flat. Most of us keep fire insurance on our house, car insurance on our cars. Now, we don't want the house to burn, and we don't want the car to get wrecked, and we don't anticipate it. But we do live our lives in readiness for certain things in case they happen. And so the scripture teaches us to be ready. This passage teaches us to be ready. And I've thought about that some. How do you live in a state of readiness? The best example I can think of would be people who are on call. Some of us in our occupation are on call and would carry a cell phone or a pager. These are things I've done in past years. And if summoned, these people are expected to either call in or come. Find out what's needed, report for duty. And this whole readiness, you could ask my wife about calls at 2 or 3 in the morning when I stumbled out of bed and got dressed and took off, and she had no clue when I would be back. I had no clue when I would be back. But it makes a difference in a life and a lifestyle. The person in question has to be ready. And the idea, this whole idea of being ready, has to be understood. It has to be accepted as part of the job. I heard about a court case brought by some employees, I believe it's down in Florida, and they were complaining to the judge that they had to be ready, and the judge told them that service to the public was so intertwined in their job that there's no way it could be separated. If you take the job, then you take the obligation to service. And because this choice of career is bound up with a strong commitment to serve, that choice is going to change the life of the person on call. The employment and commitment to serve can't be really separated. That phone can ring anytime. Could be at mealtime, 2 or 3 in the morning. But when a call comes, you go. I remember a case where we had a new general manager and there was a storm, and my phone rang at like 2 in the morning. And a very angry general manager was on the other end of the phone. He said, "I can't get people to come out. I can't get people to come out." I said, "All right." So I came into the central control and I started calling. And of course, the wives answer the phone. They say their husband is not home. I've heard all that before. And I said, "Well, you tell your husband when he gets home that Ward Neer wants him to call, and I want to hear from him. I want to hear from him tonight." Before I got through the whole list, the calls started coming in. And I got a crew out. And then after things were well in hand, I went home and caught a couple hours of sleep. And I said, "The general manager's going to be very happy with me because we got the crew going, we got the outage taken care of, it all worked out." But when I came in the morning, I faced an even angrier general manager who said, "Why would they come out for you when they wouldn't come out for me?" So sometimes you cannot win for losing. But still, nonetheless, it's an illustration of being on call. And so employees don't just wait next to the phone. They're free to live their life in a reasonable manner. But in the course of living, they've got to be ready. And so it's an attitude and a lifestyle. It doesn't matter if they're doctors or linemen. They build this readiness into their life. service to the employer is ultimately service to their fellow man. And whether the power is out of service or someone's bleeding in the emergency room, there's going to go out for help. So the Christian is on call. Each and every one of you is on call, ready to leave whatever he's doing if he has to go with Christ. And he won't be back. We won't be back. We live our lives on call. And Jesus couldn't say to his disciples he wanted to be like a doctor on call. They wouldn't have understood what he was saying. There was no pagers. There were no cell phones at that particular time. But there were servants who were expected to be ready for various reasons. And so that's what this text is about, readiness. And the example given was servants waiting for the master to come home. In those times, Yale locks had not been invented. Doors were barred from the inside. And so someone had to be inside there to let somebody in. Might be a doorkeeper that would answer and let someone in that was supposed to be in there and keep others out. And the doorkeeper would have been of very little value if he wasn't ready. I've got a little clay lamp that I bought in Jerusalem, which surprised me as to its size and shape. But I bought it because it resembled the ones they found at Masada that I knew were original lamps from that time. And they're surprisingly small, but they had a wick coming out the spout, looked like an undersized teapot, and they would light those to be ready. And so the reader is told to be dressed, keep the lamps lighted, and of course understand there were no matches at that time. And so if you're going to light a lamp, you've got to obtain a flame. Unless there's a fire burning in a fireplace somewhere, that means they would have to use flint, steel, and tinder, or there are ancient examples of boards with a groove and a hole in them where they went like this to make friction and make an ember to strike and get a fire. Well, can you imagine the master outside waiting while all this is taking place to be able to light a lamp, get dressed, and come to the door? This guy's going to be pretty hot under the collar by the time the door gets opened. And so it's not an ordinary day. The master's coming with a bride, and the wedding took place at night, and that means after the festivities were over, the master would bring his new bride home to the house. And he would naturally not expect to be kept waiting at his own door, probably telling his wife on the way home, now this is the place and the servants will be ready and everything is set. He doesn't want to have to wake a servant up by pounding on the door and then wait for a fire to be kindled so a lamp can be lit, so the servant can be dressed so he can come to the door. This would have been an annoying delay. It was customary that the new bride and groom would be pampered and treated more or less like royalty, you know, at the wedding feast and the wedding day. And so this is something the disciples could understand. Okay. All the details are not written here because everybody knew how it was done. And the promise found is that the servants waiting and ready are blessed. They would be served by the master for being faithful. This is where the example leaves the common culture and goes into Christian promise, because it's at variance. The master of the house would never have seated servants at his table and then served them. That was not done. But this is a promise for you and I. Now, it doesn't matter whether master comes in the second watch of the night, which, by the way, is 9 to midnight, or the third watch, midnight to 3. And the third watch has always seemed to be when my phone rang. when I was on call. In either case, the servants are to be ready, and the idea is that the Messiah will come at an unexpected hour, an unexpected day. We don't know when he's coming. Like the thief that comes with no advance warning, so will be the second coming. And a thief in the night, you're going to find elsewhere in the scriptures. Had the head of the house known when the thief was coming, he would have taken measures to prevent the house from being broken into. And by the same token, if we as believers knew the day that Jesus was coming, we would be ready for him. But we do not know, and the text specifically says that the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. Now, there have been historical events where some kind of a false prophet has said, the Lord is coming on this particular day. And history records that the followers have sold or disposed of their belongings and gone up and sat on the rooftop waiting. However, unfortunately for them, the expected second coming did not come. And apparently they hadn't read the text where it says, no man nor even the angels in heaven know the day and hour. But I remember a story one time about an old man in a nursing home, and he was having a very significant birthday. And because of the age he had attained and the birthday, he was sure his family would come. And so he's up earlier than usual, and he's looking. He's tottering to the window and to the door, looking out. When do you think they'll come? And throughout the day, he asked his staff whether they had seen his family. And out of pity for the old man, they scratched up a cake somewhere, and they had it there for his birthday. He wouldn't let them to cut it because he wanted to share it with his family when they come. And finally, the long day is over. They put the old man to bed. Here sets the cake on his tray, uncut. And the last thing he said to the staff was to be sure and wake him up right away when they come. It's a sad example of having an expectation of somebody coming or living in that expectation. But the Christian life is to be lived in an expectation of the return of Christ. We know he's coming. We don't know when. We know that he expects us to be about the work of the kingdom until he comes. And we know we are to love his appearing, because it's going to be a joyful event for all Christians. But aside from being ready for the second coming, for the return, we're also ready to do the needed task while we wait. Because the servant had to be ready to what? Open the door. And Jesus speaks to the disciples about a faithful and sensible steward that the master can put in charge of his servants to give them their rations at the proper time. And when we read this portion, it puts us in mind of the command to Peter on the shore of the Sea of Galilee, because Peter said, I go a fishing. And when he gets on the shore where the fire is burning, and he's asked, Simon, do you love me more than these? Feed my sheep. You're not going back to fishing. You have work to do. And so starting with the apostles and coming down to the current day, we have people in charge of the flock. And we read, blessed is that slave whom his master finds so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you that he will put him in charge of all his possessions. And then it speaks of the unfaithful servant. But the two key words here are faithful and sensible. Faithful servant will carefully do the work that needs to be done without someone standing over him. So you can send a faithful servant to do it, and you can have insurance it's going to get done. A lot of times the success or failure of any venture or any ministry hinges on the quantity of work that is done to support the ministry. Good intentions will not get you very far. I intended to do this. I intended to lay that groundwork. I intended to go here or go there. Well, but you didn't do it. And we also see the word sensible. It speaks to the concept of having the sense to know what work is needed and the best way to do it. The sensible servant knows which needs are legitimate and then is faithful to work in order to meet those needs. Now, you can run into a dead end anytime, whether you're doing work or you're doing ministry. And the question is, once you know it's a dead end, how much time and effort do you put in trying to break out of there? Or do you say, I've got to do something else? The gospel and the preaching of the gospel, these things are a trust. It must be done to the best of the ability of anyone so trusted. They're a steward of the gospel. The pastor or any position of leadership in the church is a trust. The other servants must be cared for. You don't take office in the church to be a big shot or to have people at your beck and call. More likely, you're going to be at their beck and call. And you don't do so because you desire the authority that any such position confers. You take office in a church to serve. And in that respect, you must be trustworthy. Those who are so trusted are on call, just like a doctor or lineman, because you don't know when that phone's going to ring. While we wait for the Messiah to come, we never know when one of the servants will have an immediate need. Someone might be in the emergency room, or there might be an urgent financial need, or somebody might need other kinds of help due to some sort of crisis. At that time, regular plans and regular activities have to be set aside. And off you go to minister to that person that might have that particular need. And so the text speaks to the attitude of the servants. What if we say the wait is long and he will not come anytime soon? For those of you out there that are Tolkien addicts and read the book The Return of the King, the city of Gondor had no king. They had what was called a steward, and the steward was supposed to rule until the king came back. But the line of stewards said, he's not coming, and we don't want to turn that authority over to him anyway. And so when the actual king did return, that initiated a power struggle because the steward did not want to give that over. And so we see, what if we begin to doubt that he will come during our lifetime? And this can be a detriment to our desire to be found faithful when he comes. We might be tempted to act badly, but we're told he will come on a day and an hour that we do not expect. So if you don't expect him to come today, that might be the very day that he comes. At that time, those who were trusted to take care of the servants of God and abused that trust, they will be punished. I feel bad when there's articles coming out about some kind of misuse of trust in any church or abuse. There's been quite a few articles lately about the Catholic Church. And that causes me grief, not only because of the black eye, because a church is a church is a church is in a lot of people's eyes. And in their mind, Allegheny Baptist is not separated from something that happens in a diocese of the Catholic Church. They're all the church to them. And so when somebody can accurately say you've given the enemies of God a great opportunity to blaspheme, then that's a cause for mourning. But further than that, if you are in any position of authority in the church, what you do, you are doing in the name of God. And if you think that God will not require that at your hand for whatever it is you've done wrongly in his name, then you haven't read this passage, because it clearly says the master of that slave will come on a day when he does not expect him, in an hour he does not know, and will cut him in pieces and assign him a place with unbelievers. The commentary says that doesn't mean literally cut in pieces, but it speaks to giving him some kind of a lashing that will severely punish him. And, of course, it talks about whipping later on. And so this is a cautionary for anybody who does anything from authority in the local church. I would tell you plainly, God will require it at your hand if you do wrong. So what can we learn from the text? We're waiting for the master to return, and we have a certain amount of time. We don't know how much. We have to use that time to the best of our ability till he comes. It puts me in mind of some of the other parables about the talents left by the master with his servants, and they could use them while he was gone. And we have to be ready for him to come at any hour of the day. But while we wait, there's work to do. We're not necessarily waiting with folded hands. There's work to do. And so, at any hour of the day or night, we might get a call, or we might come on to a circumstance where there's something to do. We might need to speak to an unsaved person, or there's a Christian who needs to be edified or needs help of some kind. And if that is so, then the question is that I will leave you: do you want to be a faithful and sensible servant who gives a fellow Christian what they need at the appropriate time? Now, I scarcely need to ask whether you want to be the kind of servant who abuses their position to the point where they need to be whipped when the Lord comes back, because none of us wants that. That's a fact. So, in conclusion, let us be both faithful and sensible till he comes.